Bonjour à toutes et à tous. Très très heureux de vous retrouver pour cette deuxième intervention de cette année de séminaire, la quatrième année du séminaire sur la politique juive en exil. Et cette séance est très importante. Je remercie beaucoup le professeur Melamed d'être parmi nous. Et aussi Nicolas. Nicolas, évidemment, en tant que membre du comité scientifique, mais aussi parce que le professeur Melamed, si le séminaire est parti du bouquin de Donald Trump, Persévérance du fait juif, je pense qu'avec le professeur Melamed, on a aussi persévéré parce qu'en fait, il devait intervenir déjà depuis 2019, ou plus exactement 2020, mars 2020. Vous savez ce qui s'est passé, le Covid est passé par là. Et donc, on avait dû reporter cette intervention. Quand Dan, que j'ai croisé par hasard, pas très loin de chez moi, je ne sais plus pourquoi on avait parlé du professeur Melamed, tu m'as dit qu'il passait vers la fin du mois de novembre. Tout de suite, ça a fait tilt. J'ai renvoyé un mail sur le mail où on a déjà échangé depuis 2019. Et donc, on a prévu cette session-là. Le professeur Melamed est un grand spécialiste mondial de l'œuvre de Spinoza, et c'est vraiment un honneur pour nous que vous soyez là. Et vous avez choisi un thème qui m'a surpris, mais qui est super important pour nous, surtout aujourd'hui, en ce moment, un 24 novembre 2024. Comment être antisioniste sans être antisémite? Il y va sans dire, ça ira mieux peut-être en le disant. Je voulais aussi remercier tous les membres du comité scientifique, Joe Toledano, Nicolas Veil, et ceux qui sont Dan Arbib, pardon Dan, et Avishag et Samuel qui est souffrant, qui ne sont pas là. Et vous le savez aussi, on peut faire aussi ce thème-là, on peut faire ce séminaire-là, vraiment grâce à deux personnes très très importantes que je remercie du fond du cœur, le Rav Grunstein et son épouse qui nous offrent l'hospitalité et qui accepte qu'on soit là et qu'on parle de tous les sujets, parce que c'est peut-être l'endroit où on peut ne pas être d'accord. Merci pour tout, Rav Grunstein, merci pour tout, Madame Grunstein. Et je vais passer à Nicolas la parole pour qu'il présente le professeur Melamed.
Merci beaucoup. Mais merci Alexandre de ta persévérance, puisque effectivement, ce Igan, à ce moment où le professeur Yitzhak Melamed est parmi nous, et ça fait effectivement longtemps qu'on le voulait, qu'on voulait l'entendre. Et donc je suis ravi que ça ait pu se faire enfin. Alors Yitzhak Melamed est une vieille connaissance, on s'est connu lorsque j'ai organisé à l'École Normale Supérieure un colloque sur la Haskalah, où l'on parlait beaucoup évidemment de Spinoza, de Salomon Maïmon, d'un certain nombre d'auteurs, évidemment, qui dans ce Beit Midrash peuvent paraître déviants, mais enfin, ça a été de grands moments. Puis nous avons conservé, j'ai suivi son travail sur Spinoza, dont il est devenu un des meilleur spécialiste et commentateur. Alors, Yitzhak Melamed est né en Israël, à Bnei Brak, dans le milieu de la racine des racidés Karlin. Après, il a évolué donc sans être peut-être un spinoziste, mais en tout cas vers Spinoza. Et au fond, c'est pas forcément étonnant, puisque Salomon Maïmon, sur lequel il a beaucoup travaillé, disait du racidisme que c'était au fond un spinozisme inversé. Et donc ça donne une cohérence peut-être à son itinéraire. Je ne sais pas s'il sera d'accord avec cela. Il vit et enseigne à l'université de Johns Hopkins avec sa femme Netta Stahl. Et il est l'auteur d'un certain nombre d'ouvrages. Alors, j'en ai apporté quelques-uns. Un guide critique sur le traité théologico-politique, dont vous avez parlé, Dan Arbib. Et parce qu'il y a aussi chez lui à la fois une réflexion philosophique et aussi une quête des sources et des archives. Et il l'a fait pour ce texte extraordinaire qui est l'autobiographie de Salomon Maimon, dont il a publié une traduction complète dont il a proposé une édition critique très importante. On espère que ce travail sera un jour traduit en français. Il y a quelques années, il a publié un livre très important sur la philosophie de Spinoza, donc Spinoza's Metaphysics, qui va être traduit dans la collection que co-dirige Dan Arbib au PUF Épiméthée. Donc on attend ça avec impatience. C'est pour mai, c'est ça ?
Janvier.
Ah, janvier, bon, alors c'est demain. Et récemment, il a publié une biographie de Spinoza en hébreu, parce qu'il est au fond, contrairement à la réception de Spinoza, et j'en accepte évidemment Dan Arbib, en France, très axé sur les sources juives et le côté juif de Spinoza, qu'on oppose en général. Il nous fait découvrir un Spinoza très différent, mais pas moins intéressant que ceux des Français, comme pas récemment celui de Deleuze, dont on a publié le cours sur Spinoza, dont le côté juif est totalement absent. Alors, je pensais qu'il viendrait nous parler du côté théologico-politique à la suite de Dan Arbib. Et c'est un peu pour cela qu'on l'avait invité. Mais il nous a proposé un autre sujet, plus politique, sur lequel il va nous parler en anglais. Et il sera traduit par Odaya en grammaire, que l'on remercie, bien sûr, de sa coopération. Et donc, il va nous parler du thème « Comment être très actuel un antisioniste non antisémite ?» Alors, je lui cède la parole.
Merci beaucoup, Nicolas. Bonne soirée à tous et toutes. I'm not going to speak in French. I apologize. My French is not good enough. And of course, thank you so much, Nicolas, for this very generous presentation. I chose a topic that is pretty much in the minds of many people over the past year. I think that if you look at the discourse both in Europe and in the US, and to some extent also in Israel, you see that on the right, people are claiming that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. On the left, you see people that are making claims that there is no anti-Semitism on the left. I tend to think that both sides in some way are right. I mean, sometimes it's not a surprise. I mean, I think that there is a significant body of anti-Semitism on the left, both here in Europe and in the US. I think that sometimes some figures are trying to shield Israel from some criticism that can be justified by saying that it's immediately anti-Semitism. But that's not enough. What is important is to try to see where criticism or where anti-Zionism becomes anti-Semitism. Now, because in the US, at least, my sense is that the anti-Zionism becoming more and more anti-Semitic, I think it's important to point out where precisely this is happening. And this is what I'm trying to do in this paper, in this lecture.
En général, au niveau des politiques de gauche, on a tendance à clamer qu'il n'y a pas d'antisémitisme à gauche. Et parfois, donc, il y a des personnes qui essaient de montrer que ces critiques-là sur Israël sont infondées. En tout cas, aujourd'hui, la problématique, c'est de se demander si il y a un fondement antisémite derrière l'antisionisme.
Merci. So, just in order to begin in a kind of a clear way, I would begin with a definition. So, what is anti-Zionism? I mean, I think that we know what is anti-Semitism, or at least for the most part. But the thing I'll suggest a definition of Zionism, and then you can see what anti-Zionism is. And the definition that I suggest of Zionism is that Zionism is the Jewish national movement which emerged at the end of the 19th century and whose aims was to establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. I'm stressing a homeland because there are varieties of different views of Zionism. I mean, not all forms of Zionism always supported a complete Jewish state. So some suggested a binational state. I mean, Yehuda Magnes, Gershom Scholem, and Buber were people who were strict Zionists but supported a binational state. Other, like Hadam earlier, supported a spiritual center in Palestine. I think all of those are strict Zionists. I mean, they are considered themselves as Zionists in different periods, of course. I will also stress that Zionism is not the only Jewish national movement. There are different other national movements, Jewish nationalist movement in modernity. The Bund was, to an extent, such a movement. Territorialism and perhaps also Simon Dubnov's view can be considered as a form of modern Jewish nationalism. Of course, all of these movements lost, and the primary vehicle of modern Jewish nationalism today is Zionism.
Donc, le professeur commence par questionner qu'est-ce que le sionisme, qui est un mouvement qui a émergé à la fin du 19e siècle. Donc, dans un premier temps, il indique que l'objectif du sionisme premier, c'est d'établir un foyer juif en Palestine. En l'occurrence, il y a des partisans d'un sionisme strict comme Gershom Scholem ou Buber. Donc pour eux, le sionisme, c'est un des mouvements nationalistes juifs, mais qui n'est pas le seul.
Okay. So let me begin with just a short route. I mean, a kind of a very simple way of trying to make a distinction between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. So anti-Zionism, one brand of anti-Zionism, can be motivated by the rejection of all forms of nationalism, whether it's Jewish, Palestinian, French, Kazakh nationalism, whatever. You can call this a kind of anti-nationalist anti-Zionism, and there the claim is, it's not specifically Jewish, it's just a claim that all forms of nationalism are problematic. We can discuss why, but as far as I can see, this form of nationalism is not anti-Semitic. Followers of this form of nationalism, anti-nationalist anti-Zionism, they do not carry flags of any nation. They don't go in the street with Palestinian flags. They don't go with Israeli or Iranian or French or American flags. And I think that this form of anti-Zionism, at least on the face of it, it's not anti-Semitic. Why? Because it treats Jewish nationalism on a par, just equal to any other form of nationalism, nothing specifically against the Jews. So perhaps one can make a claim that, I don't know, in the case of Judaism, nationalism is more essential. We can debate that. But I think that on the face of it, this form of nationalism in itself, I don't see it as anything anti-Semitic.
Donc il y a plusieurs manières d'être antisioniste. L'une des formes de l'antisionisme, c'est de rejeter toutes les formes de nationalisme, ce qui implique également rejeter le nationalisme français, comme tout autre nationalisme du monde entier. Donc cette forme d'antisionisme n'est pas un antisémitisme, étant donné qu'il n'est pas spécifiquement ciblé envers un État juif. C'est-à-dire que les partisans de cet antisionisme ne seraient pas des personnes qu'on verrait dans la rue avec des drapeaux palestiniens, notamment. En tout cas, ceux-ci, selon le professeur, ne sont pas considérés comme antisémites, et ils traitent en fait le sionisme de manière égale à toute autre forme de mouvement nationaliste.
Now, this is a kind of a almost classical view of anti-Zionism, I think, that you can see in the left for a century or something like that. Most anti-Zionist crowds or most anti-Zionist movements in the post-October 7th era are of different kind. When you look at the crowds of anti-Zionists today in American universities, they are happy to go with Palestinian flags, with Lebanese flags, with Iranian flags. Some of them are even happy either to go with American flags or not, but they're feeling they have no problem with nationalism. They think that some forms of nationalism are perfectly legitimate. So they are not, I would say, they are not anti-nationalist, anti-Zionist. They have a different reason for their anti-Zionism. And instead, their motivation for anti-Zionism is basically what they would call anti-colonial. The core view that you have there, they argue that Zionism is simply a late colonial movement which reinvented some sort of biblical fantasies about the Jewish return to Palestine. That it kind of the narrative that you find there is that somehow in the late 19th century, Jews decided that they want to go back to the Bible period, and reinvented a connection with the land of Palestine. According to this group of anti-colonial anti-Zionists, the Jews historically had no legitimate claim to Palestine throughout genuine human history. When I'm saying genuine human history, I contrast it with what these people would call to the mythical time of the Bible. So we'll say, yes, I mean, Jews have some claims about going back to the biblical time, but that's imagination, that's a myth. It's nothing really historical. What happened in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, it's partly an ideological fabrication, partly true, but, you know, the Bible is not a historical document. I think that anti-colonial anti-Zionism is anti-Semitic for two main reasons. First of all, it does not treat Jewish nationalism on a par with other variants of nationalism, but that's the surface problem. The deeper problems, it denies a key element of the Jewish identity throughout post-biblical history, namely the claim that it claims that Palestine, that it denies the Jewish attachment and connection to the land of to the land of Palestine, and the Jewish view of Palestine as the homeland of the Jews. Now, I'm personally not so much interested in what happened in the time of the Bible. What interests me is just the documented history from the 5th, 7th, 8th, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, and 19th century. all of these periods of time, wherever you wish, whether it's Amsterdam or Tunis or Iraq or Constantinople or Russia, I think that what you have an incredible amount of textual evidence about the Jewish attachment to the land of Israel. And it's an attachment that is documented in philosophical, liturgical, religious, social texts, literary texts. And the evidence for this kind of strong attachment to the land of Israel, I mean, it's basically, if you deny that, either you are totally a fool and don't understand anything about Judaism, or there isn't genuine anti-Semitism at stake. Because it's a denial of the key element of the identity of a community, and denying a key element of your of the identity of a community is a very serious form of racism.
Après les événements du 7 octobre, on a vu des antisionistes manifester sur les bancs des universités américaines notamment et qui portaient des drapeaux palestiniens. Ceux-ci sont des anti-sionistes anticolonialistes, des anti-sionistes anticoloniaux. En l'occurrence, ils renient l'héritage, en tout cas l'attache juive au territoire palestinien. Ils accusent les sionistes de vouloir réinventer les temps bibliques et de vouloir reconstruire en tout cas cette terre en fait mythique. Sont eux, les juifs essaient de reconstruire un mythe qui n'est plus aujourd'hui et ne considèrent pas l'attache qu'ont les juifs à la terre d'Israël comme un rapport historique. Mais comme mythique, donc c'est une manière de décrédibiliser leur attache à la terre d'Israël. Donc les antisionistes anticoloniaux sont, selon le professeur, fondamentalement antisémites, puisqu'ils ne traitent pas l'antisionisme comme une autre forme d'antinationalisme. Donc il renie hein, encore une fois la connexion des juifs à la terre de la Palestine. Et ils ne sont... En tout cas, le professeur, lui, ne se concentre pas sur l'attache, juive qui revêt des temps bibliques, mais il se concentre plutôt sur des époques plus récentes comme le 11e, 12e, 13e, 16e, 17e et même jusqu'au 19e siècle. Où on voit que les Juifs ont toujours eu cette attache à la terre d'Israël. Et ils déplorent justement que ces anti-sionistes, anticoloniaux ne prennent pas en considération cette attache. Et ce qui lui permet en fait de conclure que ces anti-sionistes, anticoloniaux sont racistes.
Merci. So this was one the brief route to try to make, but let me try to go now and break it down into a little bit more steps. So the longer route, again, I will say that in itself, anti-nationalist, anti-Zionism, as far as I can see, is both philosophically consistent view, and as I said, I don't think it's anti-Semitic. In contrast, I think that all other forms, as far as I can see, I mean, I'm open to revision, but as far as I can see, all other forms of anti-Zionism seem to be either anti-Semitic or disguise anti-Semitism, or they are simply inconsistent. They are just contradicting themselves. So let me consider a few examples of other venues that can motivate anti-Zionism. I will discuss now three examples of alternatives, which I think that each of them, at the end of the day, if you understand what they're doing, what they're saying, that they, at the bottom, I think they will be anti-Semitic.
Donc les arguments qu'a présenté le professeur sont des arguments qui sont en tout cas sont la voie courte, si je peux me permettre de traduire ainsi. Et donc, selon lui, l'antisionisme cache en réalité un antisémitisme et les autres formes, en tout cas, d'antisionisme qui existent, à part ceux qui ont déjà été présentés, sont selon lui inconsistants. Et donc, le professeur va se concentrer sur ce qui pourrait être considéré comme un anti-sionisme plus consistant au niveau de l'argument.
So one justification for anti-Zionism today is sometimes motivated by the claim that the Jews are not a nation. They are a religion, but not a nation. And as such, are not entitled to national self-determination. So you can see that, for example, this claim in the Palestinian National Charter, paragraph 20. I think you find it among various intellectuals. All I can say in response to that is the Jewish self-perception of itself as a nation or as people, as a umah or as an am in Hebrew, is extremely well documented by thousands over thousands of texts. I mean, if you just read the Jewish liturgy, I mean, the reference to Amcha Yisrael or Am Yisrael or Umateinu and Umar is just all over the text. So the Jewish view of themselves, the Jews' view of themselves as a nation or as a people, again, is documented textually better than almost anything you can imagine. I mean, so to deny this is either to be a fool, or really just to reject a body of literature for 2,000 years that, you know, that basically I don't know how can you do that. I mean, because the texts are there. I mean, and they are as common and available as they can be. I think that the other problem with this view of claiming that Jews are not a nation is that, in general, I think it is up to the community that views itself as a nation to decide whether it is a nation or not. I think it's a matter of personal self-determination. Some people can come and say, I do not define myself as Jewish nationally, and I respect that. I think that I'm even sure of that. But that's not, I'm not in a position to come and to say to other people, if you have another group of Jews, 5, 6, 10, or 12, that are saying, we are defining ourselves as Jews nationally, Jews by virtue of some sort of a national definition, I'm not in a position to deny that. Because I don't think that there is anything, I mean, all you need in order to be a nation is to have a consciousness of a nation. And once you have that, you are, by definition, you are a nation. I don't think that there is any special miracles that are needed in order to constitute a nation.
En l'occurrence, il y a une affirmation qui prône que les Juifs ne sont pas une nation. En l'occurrence, selon le professeur, cet argument n'est pas légitime puisqu'il contrevient à la légitimité de l'autodétermination propre de chaque peuple. Donc, la perception propre des Juifs d'être, en tout cas, un peuple constitué est assez bien documentée, comme on peut le voir au cours des siècles, notamment à travers la mention d'Am Israël qui se trouve dans de nombreux textes. On a en fait une littérature de 2000 ans qui recense justement le fait que le peuple juif se considère lui-même comme un peuple. Et donc, le renier ce serait contrevenir à cette légitimité d'autodétermination dont dispose chaque peuple. Selon le professeur, c'est à la communauté elle-même de se définir comme une nation ou non. Ce n'est pas à des peuples extérieurs de définir ce qu'est cette nation. En tant qu'individu, le professeur a dit qu'il peut par exemple se considérer comme comme juif en tant que nation, enfin une définition de juif qui se référait à la notion de nation, mais une personne qui serait extérieure à cette communauté ne serait pas en mesure de pouvoir l'affirmer. Selon lui, ce qui constitue le fondement même d'une nation, c'est sa conscience, la conscience même d'être une nation.
Now, there is another venue where people are trying to justify anti-Zionism, and sometimes you'll have figures, especially on the Marxist left, that are claiming that nationalism in general is wrong, but temporarily they would support nationalism in the case of Palestinians because they support nationalism of communities of underdogs. So the claim is when you have someone who is weak, you have a community that is weak, let it get strength and let it give it some support just by virtue of encouraging nationalism. And at least my experience in conversation with people who support this view, usually it's very similar to the historiography that you have in other issues of Marxism. The claim is that let's support the Palestinians till they have a state. After they have a state, they will get their rights. Then we will stop supporting nationalism, and then everyone will be equal, and then we don't need nationalism again. So the idea is that for a short period of time, there is a historical period for, I don't know, some period of time, we'll support nationalism. Then Palestinians will gain their equality among the people, and then they will also renounce nationalism. Messiah will come, whatever, that's roughly the view.
En l'occurrence, il y a une autre manière de justifier que les Juifs ne sont pas légitimes d'être constitués en tant que nation. En l'occurrence, ceux-ci supportent un nationalisme palestinien qui serait temporaire et supportent également un nationalisme, en fait, en l'occurrence, qui est celui des opprimés. La défense du nationalisme palestinien aurait seulement pour objectif l'émancipation du peuple palestinien pour qu'il se constitue en tant que nation, et qu'une fois ce droit des Palestiniens acquis, on n'aurait donc plus besoin de ce nationalisme des opprimés palestiniens.
So, in response, I would like to make three points. First of all, I think that offering free heroin to the poor is not a way of supporting them. If you think that nationalism is a poison, you should stay away from that and should make sure that everyone stay away from that. Giving a special group, even if they are weak, a permission to use nationalism, if nationalism is a poison, you are just giving them heroin. It's not going to help them. Secondly, I think that if you look at the circumstances of the establishment of the State of Israel in 1945 till 1948, the Jews were underdogs. I mean, at least as much as underdogs as the Palestinians are right now, and following the events of World War II. And as such, if you want to make a special case to say underdogs, they have a special permission to use nationalism till their establishment of their state, then you'd have to say, yeah, perfectly legitimate. I mean, the expulsions or whatever that happened in 1948 in Nakba was perfectly justified because it's nationalism, right? I mean, we are saying that underdogs are allowed to have nationalism without any constraints. But this, I don't think that this is a conclusion that most pro-Palestinians are going to accept. I mean, their chief complaint is about 1948. In 1948, I mean, again, the Jews were also underdogs, actually at least as much underdogs as the Palestinians. The third point I would like to stress is that promising a future in which Palestinian nationalists will ultimately denounce nationalism after years in which they will enthusiastically enthusiastically accept and celebrate nationalism, this assumes a human nature that is nowhere to be found. If people are trained in nationalism, if they are get used to nationalism, they are going to celebrate nationalism, and then after they establish a state, you tell them, no, that's it. Enough is enough. Now you are going to be, you don't have a right for nationalism. It's nonsense. It's not going to happen. I mean, there is no human nature that will tell you, yeah, we will at some point, we will renounce our nationalism. It's almost like basically trying to feed some sort of a tendency or a fantasy or a spirit of a nation, and then to ask people to withdraw from that. This is not going to happen. I mean, it's simply just a fantasy that simply has no roots in any kind of reasonable human nature.
Donc, en l'occurrence, le professeur vient apporter trois points qui, à son sens, permettent de déconstruire les arguments qui ont été cités précédemment. Le premier, c'est qu'il dit que de donner de l'héroïne à des pauvres n'est pas une manière de les aider. C'est-à-dire que si tous les nationalismes sont un poison, alors dans ce cas... injecter du nationalisme aux Palestiniens et du nationalisme en général n'aide pas le peuple en question. Le deuxième point, c'est que de 1945 à 1948, les Juifs aussi étaient un peuple opprimé. Ils étaient aussi opprimés que les Palestiniens au lendemain de la guerre. Et, en l'occurrence, les opprimés ne peuvent avoir de nationalisme sans contrainte. Le troisième point, c'est que promettre un futur où les Palestiniens auraient besoin seulement temporairement du nationalisme pour s'émanciper, puissent ensuite le mettre de côté une fois qu'ils en ont utilisé les bénéfices, c'est une idée un peu folle qui c'est difficile à imaginer dans la mesure où on encourage le nationalisme auprès des Palestiniens, mais ceux-ci vont en être fiers. Ils ne vont pas vouloir y renoncer à partir du moment où ils ont fini par acquérir leurs droits en tant qu'individus sur une terre. Donc, essayer de nourrir une tendance, puis de demander à un peuple de ne plus, en tout cas, de ne plus compter justement sur cet élément, ce n'est pas quelque chose de raisonnable.
Finally, one third way of justifying anti-Zionism is, again, an issue that I discussed before. It's sometimes motivated by the claim that Zionism is based on the ideological fabrication of the Jewish connection to Palestine, that it's a fiction. And all I can say again in response, as I said before, the Jewish view of Palestine or land of Israel as their homeland from which they were exiled is documented by thousands over thousands of texts. It's not a biblical fantasy. I mean, it's documented from texts from the 5th century, 6th century, 7th century, 8th century, 9th century, 10th century, 11th century, 12th century, all the way. And this denial of the Jewish attachment to Palestine is simply not serious. I mean, it's just to say something which is, it's almost like someone who will say that Christianity has nothing to do with Christ or something like that. I mean, it's just a joke. Now, the interesting thing is that frequently this view relies on pretty appalling conspiracy theories. So I don't know how much you are familiar, but there is an interesting work by, influential work, I mean, and a horrible work by an Israeli historian called Shlomo Zand, who made the claim that the Jews are an invented nation because they are just descendants of the Khazarians. It's a view that Arthur Koestler suggested in the 1940s, but the problem with Zand is that Zand himself is a very mediocre historian of 19th century France. I mean, I don't think that any one of you ever heard about him. Again, he's a mediocre historian. Then he makes claim about Jewish history, and he's unable to read half a page of rabbinic Hebrew. If you would be asked to translate, just as a student, translate rabbinic Hebrew into Hebrew or into French or into any other language, he will not be able to do that because he cannot understand that. So he's making all kinds of claims that are any scholar of medieval Jewish history is just reading these claims and then starts laughing. Now, the interesting thing is that this book of Zand appear in some of the best publishing houses, in verso, in English, and you find superb historians. You find historians like some superb historians that are praising the book. I mean, although it's basically an ideological bent. It's leftist historians. I forgot the name some of these people, but are really some of the very top historians that were active in the past 20, 30 years. And the only reason they like the book is because it fits their ideology. And it's hard. I mean, on my side, all I can say is that it's hard to find a more combination of so Tony Judd, for example, is one person from that from NYU. I don't have the names, but it's amusing to find people historians who are not qualified to pay judgment because they themselves don't read medieval Hebrew. But suddenly, you know, when it comes to Jewish history, they are, you know, all their required professional requirements of philology, of serious philology, serious requirements of having access to the text, all of them, they just disappear. Suddenly, when the text is ideologically useful, you don't care about professional ethics. You don't care about the ability of being able to do serious philology and read the text in their original language. What you have instead is just crappy scholarship that is covered with the right ideology.
En l'occurrence, on peut remarquer que l'attache des Juifs à Israël est documentée depuis des siècles, depuis le 5e, 6e, 8e siècle, qui remonte à une époque assez ancienne. Par conséquent, renier l'héritage, l'attache en tout cas juive à Israël, ce n'est pas sérieux. Et selon le professeur, ça repose sur la théorie du complot. En l'occurrence, il y a un historien israélien nommé Shlomo Zand.
Zand.
Zand, pardon, excusez-moi. Même Shlomo Zand, donc qui affirme que les Juifs sont une nation qui en réalité descend des Khazars.
Les Khazars. Oui.
Selon le professeur, la thèse de cet historien n'est pas sérieuse. D'une part, parce que cet historien ne sait pas traduire, ni lire d'ailleurs, donc, par conséquent de l'hébreu rabbinique, il ne sait pas le traduire d'une, de l'hébreu rabbinique à une autre langue comme le français, enfin, ce qui montre qu'il n'y a pas de fondement théorique et d'études sérieuses derrière la thèse de cet historien. Et en l'occurrence, les professeurs qui lisent cette thèse sont des partisans, des historiens partisans de mouvements de gauche d'il y a 20 ou 30 ans environ. Et en général, ceux-ci lisent ce livre parce que cela vient confirmer leur idéologie propre. Le professeur s'étonne de ne pas voir d'historien qualifié, d'études philologiques sérieuses au moment où on est censé justement expliquer l'origine de l'attache des Juifs à Israël à travers les textes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just now remember the other major historian who praised so much. It's Eric Hobsbawm.
Oh.
Eric Hobsbawm, major historian, Marxist. I have no problem with that. But when Eric Hobsbawm is going to write that this is a tour de force, and it's a joke. It's literally a joke. And then try to understand what is he doing. He's not doing scholarship. Okay. So now we can ask calm ourselves and try to ask, is there any other argument that could defend non-anti-Semitic anti-Zionism? I think a general rejection of nationalism seems to be perfectly legitimate on the face of it. But perhaps there is another form of anti-Zionism that is legitimate. And all I can say that I'm not aware of any. On the face of it, if one is first of all considered nationalism as generally legitimate, two, recognizes the claim that some Jews, at least, or many Jews, claim that Jews are a nation and thinks that people have a right for self-determination. Thirdly, he does not delude himself in selling nationalist soap to the underdogs. And finally, recognizes the deep historical attachment of the Jews to the land of Palestine. If you have all of these four points you agree on, it would seem that this brand of anti-Zionism is not motivated. There is no justification for that. And it's most likely, again, if you accept these four points, I cannot see what other motivation for anti-Zionism can be brought. Perhaps I'm wrong, but all I'm saying is that at this point, I think that the burden of proof lies on the other side. If there is a version of anti-Zionism that is not anti-Semitic and is not, as I said, a general rejection of nationalism, well, I think that at this point, the argument should be made. I mean, I would like to see the argument coming from the other side because I don't see the alternative, and you know, I don't see any kind of serious alternative that is presented here.
En l'occurrence, il y a le professeur se demande quels sont les arguments qui permettent de défendre un anti-sionisme qui ne serait pas un antisémitisme. À son sens, il existe quatre arguments pour cela. Donc, le premier, c'est de considérer que le nationalisme, de manière générale, est illégitime, comme on a pu le voir. Le deuxième argument, ce serait de reconnaître les Juifs comme une nation qui a la capacité de s'auto-déterminer. Le troisième argument serait de ne pas postuler pour ce nationalisme temporaire, comme on l'a vu, qui est destiné à libérer les opprimés. Et le quatrième argument serait de reconnaître l'attachement des Juifs, l'attachement historique des Juifs à Israël.
OK. Now, let me just note, however, that I think that claiming that the Jews have a right to or claim to Palestine is not supposed to exclude the claim that there are other people that can have a right. And you know, what you do in such a situation is you just open Baba Metzia, chapter 1, זה אומר כולה שלי, זה אומר כולה שלי, יחלוקו. I mean, if you have two people that are competing and saying they both have serious claims on the same entity, and both claims are serious, then you have to make a compromise. You have to divide. Of course, there is huge Talmudic discussion about what does it mean, yachloku, what kind of claims are supposed to be a claim that that you have this right. But I think that's... all I'm saying is that the Jews have a strong reason, a strong claim on the land of Palestine. I don't think I have no reason, and I don't want to make a claim that the Palestinians do not have a claim. All I'm saying is that the Jews have this claim.
Cependant, affirmer le droit des Juifs de revendiquer un droit sur la Palestine ne signifie pas pour autant que les autres, en l'occurrence les Palestiniens, les autres peuples, n'ont pas le droit de vivre sur cette terre. Il faut un compromis. Si les Juifs ont de sérieuses raisons de réclamer la terre, en tout cas d'Israël, alors cela n'exclut pas le fait que les Palestiniens n'ont aucun droit d'habiter sur cette terre.
Merci. So let me finish with one small consideration. I mean, I would call it the Moses Hess moment. Moses Hess was a leading figure of the left in Europe at the end of the 19th century, at which point, I think, he saw that many of his friends on the left were also actually tolerant of anti-Semitism. And his solution was basically to move towards Zionism. Now, I have to admit, I mean, I'll open my cards. I'm not a nationalist of any sort. I mean, I'm not a Zionist. I don't think Zionism is horrible. I mean, I don't think that it's worse than any other kind of nationalism. But my rejection of nationalism assumes that my fellow human beings, other human beings, whether are Gentiles or Jews alike, are committed to my well-being, just as they are committed to the well-being of any other people. Now, in light of other of the recent outbursts of violent anti-Semitism in so many quarters of the academic left, especially in the U.S., but I've seen that. I mean, I cannot reject that. I cannot deny that because I have eyes. I do occasionally wonder whether this assumption of mine, whether I'm naive, you know, whether assumption of mine is not naive, because I assume that my friends and colleagues who are Jewish or not Jewish, especially non-Jewish, will also stand by me against anti-Semitism on the left. And I can say that the results are mixed. I mean, I think that there are, you see people on the left in the U.S. that are understanding that what is at stake is anti-Semitism, and you see people that are not. All this being said, I still tend to stay with my view of rejecting nationalism because, you know, I prefer, you know, we all have a certain period of life, and that's and I prefer to live this certain period of life as a decent human being. I mean, I prefer to even if rejecting nationalism requires some payment of price on my side, I tend to think that I prefer to pay that because I want to live as a decent human being. I don't want to discriminate other people, and I don't want to cause harm to other people. But again, all this being said, I don't know. I mean, perhaps in 5-10 years my views will be different, but I can tell you where I am right now. Thank you.
Donc le professeur cite Moses S. Le bon moment sera Moses S. Moment, un moment de Moses S. qui est une figure importante du 19e siècle. En l'occurrence, ses amis de gauche toléraient d'une certaine manière l'antisémitisme. Le professeur, en l'occurrence, affirme qu'il n'est pas sioniste, il n'est pas nationaliste. Il ne pense pas que le sionisme est une forme de nationalisme pire que les autres. Le professeur croit fondamentalement que les autres sont engagés vis-à-vis de son bien-être. Il se demande si son hypothèse est naïve. En l'occurrence, il ne sait pas exactement si les autres défendraient les autres, par exemple, en l'occurrence, les non-juifs, défendraient l'antisémitisme de manière générale. En tout cas, le professeur rejette fondamentalement le nationalisme. Il veut vivre comme un homme décent, même si cela implique de payer un tribut de son côté. Cependant, ce qui reste très important pour lui, c'est de ne pas discriminer les autres. Peut-être qu'il changera d'avis dans 30 ans, mais en tout cas aujourd'hui, il souhaite vivre comme un homme décent qui ne veut pas discriminer ses semblables qui vivent en terre de Palestine.
Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup, Odaya, de cet exercice de travail de l'argument typiquement américain, sans être nationaliste, dans mes qualifications. Vous avez, donc, si je comprends bien, et j'ai profité de ma position pour poser la première question. Le nationalisme, on peut être légitimement anti-sionisme à condition qu'on soit anti-nationaliste.
Oui.
Pourtant, je vois une légère difficulté dans l'argument que vous placez dans les sources. Dans les sources millénaires qui attestent d'un attachement, puisque les sources millénaires qui attestent, selon vous, d'un attachement à ce que vous appelez la Palestine, en fait, ne sont pas, sont difficilement conciliables avec le nationalisme moderne dont est issu le sionisme. Alors, comment vous pouvez en faire un argument?
Just the last two sentences. I mean, you mind translate? Would you mind translating the last two sentences?
Oui, je vous laisse. Je vous laisse peut-être, d'ailleurs, vous pouvez.
Oui.
Oui.
Just the last two sentences, or everything else I understood well.
OK. He thinks that the arguments are pretty difficult to understand, especially with today's modern nationalism.
OK.
Parce que les sources.
Yes, because the resources are insufficient.
Non, parce que les sources ne parlent pas de la même nation que celle du sionisme moderne.
Because the resources do not talk about the same nationalism. They talk about the modern nationalism. They don't talk about the initial nationalism.
Oh, sure. Sure. I think Nicolas, you are right. I mean. Jews were speaking about about the Jewish Amcha Yisrael or Umateinu in the 7th century, and they were not speaking about the modern notion of nation, right? I get that, absolutely. But you can see that there is a continuity there. And unless you think that, you know, that unless you think that there is something special happening in the 19th century, which is, you know, totally, I mean, the question is whether do you have a community that is thinking of itself as having a special unit, a special culture, etc. And I think the answer is Historically, yes. So in some ways, I mean, Jews were, at least as far as I can see, there were people long before, I mean, much of modern nationalism. Now, is there a modern nationalism today? Yes, of course, Zionism. Zionism is modern nationalism. So, and I think that the question is, so am I going now to say that Jews were never considered themselves as a nation? In the 19th century, you have both the new Jewish nationalism of Zionism, and you have the traditional perception of the Jews as a people. Either way, either this way or that way, you have the Jews perceiving themselves as a national unit.
Traduis peut-être la réponse. Donc, en l'occurrence, le professeur indique qu'effectivement, au 7e siècle, notamment l'idée de nation moderne n'était pas encore constituée comme elle a pu l'être par la suite au 19e siècle notamment. En revanche, il y a une continuité qui se produit d'une culture particulière au 19e siècle. Enfin, les Juifs n'étaient pas des nationalistes modernes, en tout cas auparavant, avant le 19e siècle, mais il y a toujours eu cette question qui a existé, que les Juifs se sont considérés comme une nation au sens traditionnel et se sont perçus comme un peuple uni.
Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres questions? Allez-y.
I may ask my question in English. If you want, and maybe then we will translate it. Merci. It's kind of few things. The first one, now that Israel exists, should we talk about Zionism or anti-Zionism because the state exists? And it's kind of a luxury that it exists, because before the state existed, Jews were in very hard conditions all over the world and all over the centuries. So now it's kind of a luxury to ask ourselves as Jews, am I Zionist? Do I want to live in Israel? Or I'm not a Zionist and I prefer to live in the diaspora? But it's kind of a luxury, because without Israel existing, then we will still be this this nation, quote, that can be thrown away, killed, raped, with pogroms all over the world. The existence of Israel, the state of Israel, makes kind of security for all Jews in the world. So I think using the word Zionist or anti-Zionist shouldn't be, we should speak, I'm for the existence of Israel, or I am against the existence of Israel.
Ou alors directement, traduire rapidement.
Oh, je peux traduire aussi.
Vas-y.
Ouais, je peux traduire. Donc, ce que j'ai dit, c'est que je trouve que l'utilisation du mot sioniste et anti-sioniste, c'est pas forcément approprié. Et être anti-nationaliste ou nationaliste par rapport à Israël, c'est un peu décalé, parce que l'existence d'Israël, être nationaliste en France, c'est être par rapport à un pays qui existe déjà, avoir une position nationaliste ou antinationaliste. Être contre l'existence, être antisioniste, c'est être contre l'existence de l'État d'Israël. Et c'est pas du tout la même façon de se positionner. Et ça pose un problème, et ça pose un problème d'après moi par rapport à la sécurité des Juifs dans le monde, parce qu'il y a une forme de confort et de luxe en tant que Juif de se dire je suis nationaliste, donc je vais vivre en Israël, ou je ne suis pas nationaliste et je vais vivre en diaspora. Mais l'existence même du pays, d'Israël en tant que pays, nous offre une sécurité à l'ensemble des Juifs. Enfin, c'est vraiment mon opinion personnelle. Et je, I would like to know what is your...
So, I'll say a few things. First of all, I think that just in terms of the future flourishing and saving of the Jewish people, it's important that Israel will not be the only center of Jews. I think it's important there will be Jews in the diaspora. Partly, you know, there is a midrash saying Tzedakah asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu im Yisrael shepizran ben ha'umot, which means that God did mercy with the people of Israel, that he dispersed them among the nations. And the idea is that that's what allowed for Jewish survival. I think that just putting all the Jews in Israel, it's an extreme risk, because God knows what will happen there. So that's one point. With regard to Israel, I care much about Israel. I want Israel to be safe and healthy and good place, and a place where Jews can survive, can thrive and have. What I can say is that till October 7th, I was open to the idea of a binational state, what you would call in Hebrew, Medinat Kol Ezracheya, a state that will, for both Jews and Palestinians equally, etc. And I think it's not realistic now. I think that right now, if you just open the borders, have a binational state, it's going to be a series of massacres of one against the other. It's a mess. I don't see any future for a binational state, at least in the next 30 or 40 years. Because I care about human beings, both Jews and Palestinians, and I want them, and I think that right now the reasonable solution is to have a separation, separate the two nations, I mean, have them, each of them, bury their dead, recover, have a conversation, try to think together about a better way, better future. But creating a one-state solution right now seems to be just a recipe for disaster. All this being said, you know, I'm not a great admirer of nationalism in general. Partly, I didn't mention that also because, you know, I think that nationalism, modern nationalism, was partly a replacement for religion. And I have one God. I don't need a second one. I mean, I think that all the rituals around the state, the flag, all of these kind of does not speak to me. I mean, I think it's partly there is a notion in rabbinic language called avak avodah zarah, which is literally to mean dust of idolatry. It means a little bit of idolatry. And I think that all the rituals around the state have a little bit of idolatry. I don't want to be part of that. Practically, I agree with you. I want Israel right now. I care about Israel. I want it to be healthy. I want it to be strong. I think that part of its strength should also be an ability to live well with its neighbors. Because otherwise, my fear that right now, if we continue as things are right now, it's going to explode in either some sort of a nuclear catastrophe, God knows why. Sure.
En l'occurrence, il y a plusieurs points que le professeur mentionne. Le premier, c'est que en termes de pérennité pour pour le peuple juif, c'est important qu'il y ait des juifs également à l'extérieur d'Israël. Donc le professeur a cité un verset de la Baba Kama, un verset de Baba Kama qui indique que Hachem a dispersé les juifs. Selon lui, c'est une manière de dire que ça a aidé la survie du peuple. Deuxièmement, pour le professeur, si il n'y avait qu'un seul État, cela conduirait à un massacre total. Un État binational. Oui, pardon. Et ce ne serait pas réaliste. Et qu'avoir justement deux États séparés serait la solution. Si j'ai bien
mal. Pas maintenant.
J'avance à tout le temps de penser qu'il y aurait. Oui. Pardon.